Welcome to the podcast. I'm Dr. Val Jones, founder of GetBetterHealth.com. Today I'll be speaking with Dr. Bill Kosmal about current controversies in heart disease diagnosis and treatment. Dr. Kosmal is the Associate Director of the Cardiac Catheterization Laboratory at Hahnemann Hospital in Philadelphia and an Associate Editor of Annals of Internal Medicine, a journal of the American College of Physicians. Welcome to the podcast, Dr. Kosmal.
Thank you very much.
You know, February is Heart Disease Awareness Month, so I've been trying to make myself aware of some of the heart-related controversies in primary care and cardiology, and I have to say, they're pretty thorny, and I'm very relieved that you're here to help me and my audience navigate our way through. So to get started, let's just wade into our first issue, which is, who should receive high-dose statin therapy?
Well, I think the treatment of cholesterol is something every practitioner deals with, and I can see the field evolving quite a bit over time from a situation where people only looked at their total cholesterol to a situation now where almost every practitioner knows to break it down to the LDL and HDL components and teach their patients not to worry about the total cholesterol and just look at the bad and the good. Along with that, as you know, there have been a number of guidelines and different ways to approach what is an optimal LDL cholesterol level. And I think people still aren't quite sure what to do with that. At least I know, even I am not. Is a goal 130? Is it 100? Is it 70? Should we even look at the LDL when we decide who to treat and with what dose to treat them? There is some interesting studies along those lines, some using high-dose statins, as you just said in your lead-in. And interestingly, it's really not clear whether it's the LDL level that makes the difference or whether just more of these statin drugs is better.
And what about the highly sensitive CRP levels? Is that a target that we should be looking at?
Interestingly, our better-informed patients often will ask us to get a CRP level, and they ask me to do it more often than I'm really interested in doing it, to be honest. But I would say the field came awake to it more a year or two ago when a study called the Jupiter Study was published in the New England Journal. Now, this was a study that was investigating whether you should treat people even though their LDL cholesterol wasn't all that high if their CRP level, C-reactive protein level, was increased. Just to emphasize, this was in primary prevention, not people who already have coronary disease. So the study randomized folks like this who had quote-unquote normal LDL cholesterol levels but an elevated C-reactive protein level and randomized them to placebo or a statin called rosuvastatin. And lo and behold, the rosuvastatin group had a much better outcome in this study. So this ignited a whole lot of interest in the C-reactive protein level.
And I think in the media, I remember seeing calls for putting statins in the water supply.
You know, it almost has reached that level. I mean, if you think about it, we have fluoride in the water, right? We have vitamin D in the milk.
Yeah.
We have folic acid in the bread. We just have to figure out which foodstuff we should put statins in, and we'll be all set. And I'm being half facetious, but statins are pretty amazing drugs. And the whole fascinating thing about them is that it seems that they have benefits that go beyond what we can measure with cholesterol levels. It just seems that people do better when they're on a statin.
So what do you think your bottom line is here for the primary care physician faced with a person, with elevated, let's say, LDL? At what point do they start treatment, and when would they get a CRP level? You said you weren't too excited about it. It's a little bit of a gray zone, isn't it?
It is, and I'll get back to that in a second. But I think practitioners are best off following the current NCEP guidelines, which involve calculating the patient's Framingham risk using the standard cardiac disease risk factors that we all know and love, and then deciding if their patient is low, medium, or high risk based on whether their 10-year Framingham risk is very, very low or 10% or 20% or higher. And then the NCEP guidelines, which were updated a couple years ago, tell us what to do with the LDL. For example, patients with very low risk who have no cardiac risk factors whatsoever, the current recommendation is that LDL should be less than 160. So that basically means you don't have to do anything for most people. whereas people who are at high risk who have a 10-year framing M-risk greater than 20%. The current guideline says to lower the LDL to less than 100, and I'm quoting from the guideline here, consideration should be given to lowering it to less than 70. And that's where we stand, and I think practitioners are probably safe if they're following that guideline at the moment, pending more data. When do I get CRP levels? I don't get CRP levels very often. In fact, interestingly, your listeners who read the New England Journal probably know that the New England Journal sort of did a straw poll of their readership after the Jupiter trial and asked people, okay, now are you measuring CRP? Well, most people aren't. They just aren't convinced yet that it's adds that much to the prognostic picture that we should be doing that. So I do it selectively. I do it in people who I'm very worried about them for some other reason.
And the straw poll I think I saw asking if the Jupiter trial would change their management, 50% said yes and 50% said
yes.
No.
That's not
goodness.
Terribly impressive, is it? Yeah.
It's like, so, wow.
Well, I think well, that's what we should do, though. As practitioners, we shouldn't jump on every new trial, even if the results seem impressive. I think, you know, you really do wait to see if there's confirmatory evidence in another trial.
Now, I'd like to go to controversy number two. We were talking about risk stratifying people, which I think is relevant to the question of the role of coronary artery calcium scoring. How do you establish that someone is a good candidate for this test, and what do you do with the results?
This is one of the hottest controversies in cardiology. I guess one of the things that ignites the controversy is that you can get this test in a completely non-invasive manner without giving any contrast. We're not talking about computed angiography here at the moment, although we may get to that as another controversy, but just putting somebody in a CT scanner, either an electron beam or a multi-slice standard CT scanner, and looking for the presence or absence of calcium in the coronary arteries. This has been a technique known about for a long time. And in a way, it's still searching for a niche. I guess the problem is that if you don't have any coronary calcium, you're very, very unlikely to have a cardiac event, whether you're symptomatic or asymptomatic. And that makes this test very attractive for ruling out coronary disease. The problem is that if you do have a little bit of calcium, then more testing gets done, right? I mean, what would you do next? You'd have to say, well, maybe I should get a stress test, and if that's not normal, then maybe I should do a cath. And you sort of set a train in motion, and you end up wondering whether you're doing more harm than good by screening a lot of asymptomatic patients. I can tell you that the USPS TF Task Force, which reviewed all of this information last year, and the review of this is in the Annals 2009, says that there just isn't enough data to recommend using calcium scoring for asymptomatic screening, for screening of patients that are asymptomatic. And I would agree with that. I don't think they should be screened because of the factors that I mentioned. Just one thing keeps leading to another. Now, the other situation is, what about a patient who comes to the emergency room with chest pain? Wouldn't it be great if instead of keeping them for 8 hours for several sets of enzymes before then having to decide whether to admit them or not, you could just whip them right over to the CT scanner, find out they don't have any coronary calcium, and send them home? And I actually, and that's been done, it's been studied, it's a fairly effective way of triaging patients. And I think that's something that we could look at as a model even for emergency room use.
Now, I was reading on the Mayo Clinic website that they suggested that if a person is risk stratified to the intermediate heart attack risk category, that might be a group of people who would benefit most from the test. Is that still kind of the thought on this, that, you know, if you don't have any risk, you don't need the test? If you have a lot of risk, you don't need it because you probably have heart attack.
You probably have it anyway.
People in the middle, you know?
Sure, but that's a truism, isn't it? I mean, almost every test is most useful in the intermediate risk group. You're just trying to push the patient to one end of the spectrum or the other. And some patients are very worried. I mean, I have one or two patients who ask me to cath them almost every visit because they're so worried they might have heart disease, and I have to talk them out of it. So once in a while, getting a CT scan that's normal is useful. But I would say that in the vast majority of patients, it may cause more trouble than it helps.
Mm. So your bottom line is that this test might be useful as a triage?
I think for acute chest pain patients, it might be useful. That gets folded into another whole topic, which is computed angiography, because in the emergency setting, you have an acute chest pain patient. There are several diagnoses that are in your mind, not only acute coronary syndrome, but aortic dissection or pulmonary embolism. And by getting a computed angiographic test of the chest, including the heart and the aorta and the pulmonary arteries, you can rule in or out all three of those.
Nice.
At least potentially.
Yes, that's right. You kill two birds with one stone.
Or even three.
That's correct. So, moving on to controversy number three, has coronary CT angiography made coronary catheterization obsolete?
Well, I did five cases today in the invasive cath lab, so apparently it's not putting us out of business in the cath lab. Nope. Yeah, I have to disappoint folks on that. It gives interesting data, and it's getting better and better. The resolution of CT angiography, and just for your listeners, just to emphasize the difference between what we're talking about now and what we talked about a moment ago, now we're talking about not only subjecting the patient to the radiation dose of a CT scan, which, by the way, is at least as much as a cath, but we're also giving them about as much dye or more than they would get with a cath when we're doing a CT angiogram, just to mention that. The technique is improving, and they're trying to reduce that dose all the time, and I'm sure that technical improvements will bring that about. But that's a factor that not every physician and certainly not every patient recognizes. At any rate, what kind of pictures do we get, and how good are they at ruling out coronary disease? They're good if they're totally normal, but they're not so good if there's plaque in the wall of the artery that you can see on the CT scan, and maybe there's even calcium. And when there's calcium, then the CT image becomes degraded.
Mm-hmm.
When there's a stent in the artery already and you're looking for restenosis, you just do not get good pictures. The metal in the stent completely degrades the image, and you cannot tell what's going on inside the stent.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say that, and I tend to be conservative about these things, and, in order to completely reveal my conflicts of interest, I am an invasive cardiologist, so I may have a slant on this, but honestly, I probably have seen more patients come to the cath lab because their CT angiography was equivocal than almost any other test.
Wow, that's fascinating. And so the fourth controversy that I think we should probably touch on has to do with stents, which you mentioned. Did the COURAGE study kill stenting, do you think?
It started to, until people thought about it. You're referring to a study that was published, I forget exactly the year, it was recent, maybe it was 2 years ago, in the New England Journal, 2 or 3 years ago, that said that it didn't make any difference if you did angioplasty, patients did just as well. At least what I just said is how it was reported. The thing to remember about this study is that, first of all, it was a very big and very well-done study. I have no particular complaints about the study, but it was done in patients who are either asymptomatic or had very stable angina. So we're not talking about patients who got admitted to the hospital for unstable angina, and we're certainly not talking about patients who are having acute MIs.
Mm.
Nobody is arguing that it isn't a good thing to do to take an acute MI patient to the cath lab and put in a stent. And nobody pretty much is arguing that if the patient's in the hospital for unstable angina, that taking an invasive approach isn't the right thing to do. That's pretty uncontroversial. The COURAGE trial is telling us that if you have a patient who has stable angina, that they should get optimal medical therapy, and you should see if that works. And if it doesn't work or they get worse, then you take them to the cath lab. Stated that way, this is not a revelation. This is what we've always been doing or should have been doing with patients, always giving them optimal medical therapy first. So in a way, after the smoke cleared and the controversy died down, I don't really think the COURAGE trial killed anything. I think it just emphasized that optimal medical therapy is good and that it's always the first step.
Excellent. Now, is there still remaining controversy about the type of stent to use?
Yes, I think that's another controversy that the pendulum has swung, hasn't it? I mean, drug-eluting stents took the field by storm starting in 2003, and they promised to cure everything. I mean, you would never have restenosis, and everybody would go home happy and live forever. Like all miracle events in medicine, there has been a downside to them. I would say the main downsides to drug-eluting stents are, number one, that although they definitely do prevent restenosis, restenosis is usually not a fatal event, so they're really not preventing heart attacks and deaths. Number two, there is a small, and I emphasize small, ongoing risk of stent thrombosis, meaning that the stent suddenly clots off and the patient has a large acute MI. The risk of that may, and I emphasize may, be very, very slightly higher with drug-eluting stents, but that risk also exists with non-drug-eluting stents. So as much as that's been in the press in the last couple of years, I don't think that's a major issue. What is a major issue is that drug-eluting stents require a prolonged period of therapy with combined antiplatelet agents, aspirin plus either clopidogrel or perhaps one of the other newer agents coming along. And that is very expensive. So putting in a drug-eluting stent is not as quick a cure as we once thought. Having said that, if I needed a stent, I would have a drug-eluting stent put in.
You've been listening to a podcast interview with Dr. Bill Kosmal. I'm Dr. Val Jones, founder of GetBetterHealth.com.